Michael Brush publishes the stock newsletter Brush Up on Stocks and writes for the website MarketWatch. BrushUpOnStocks.com is where you can find him. And I'm speaking with him today to see what investment lessons we can learn when we see good companies experience setbacks, whether it's in the form of food scares experienced recently like by Chipotle, or way back when Jack in the Box in 1993, or even Taco Bell in 1996. These events happen, and an astute investor can do well if they truly understand and know what to do. Michael Brush, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So, you know, we have seen this before, as I just mentioned. Well-regarded companies make mistakes. It's bound to happen. Everybody makes mistakes. And then the stocks suffer big drawdowns. And you have to wonder, you know, if these are opportunities, how do I take advantage of them? But of course, knowing surely that there's risk and one has to be cautious. So, Michael, how does one separate fact from fear?
Well, this is probably the most important aspect of investing because, you know, people come to me all the time and they say, hey, you know, these shoes are really popular, or here's what I think about the economy. And that's step one. But step two, which is really the key step that a lot of beginning investors kind of don't know about or leave out, is has everybody else figured that out? Because if you know that and everybody else has and it's priced into the stock, well, it really doesn't help you that much. And in fact, you could buy at the wrong time because you're buying when everybody else is buying. So this is sort of the inverse of that. And we're looking at kind of contrarian investing here and saying, okay, something happened. Basically, you want to ask, is this a one-off event? Is this a fixable event? And if everybody's frightened and you think that they're wrong because the problem is fixable, then you have an interesting investing situation. That's the point here.
So I guess the question is, how do you know the difference? I mean, you could have a company that goes down in price, but maybe they go out of business.
And right, exactly.
You can still pay too much, or you have a company. You know, here's a good example. Toyota got into some serious problems with their manufacturing some years ago, but so did a company by the name of Suzuki Motors that had the Samurai, this little cute Samurai SUV, and or it was like really a Jeep. And, you know, in full disclosure, I have to say I made the bright decision before the problems to buy it. So I got stuck with that. But, you know, it's a good example of one company, you know, disappeared and another company rebounded again. How do you tell the difference?
Well, one of the keys here with these consumer-facing companies is the brand power. So that Suzuki-Toyota contrast is a great one to consider because Toyota, we all know, has been around for years, and they've had some problems. But because they had really decades worth of a reputation of selling a quality car, people were more able to kind of say, okay, this is a one-off issue. They'll fix it. It'll probably go away. Whereas with Suzuki, it was kind of a new brand. It was kind of unknown. And, you know, it's the old fear of the unknown thing, right? And people just were less willing to embrace that company because they didn't know and trust the brand that well. And that's kind of the key here is you got to consider, like, how much brand equity is there in the name.
Yeah, if you make a mistake, it's the old joke, you know, that something is a goodbye. Goodbye house, goodbye car.
Right, you know, right.
Goodbye retirement. So you have to be particularly careful. So let's say a company that has a good brand, good reputation, has a temporary setback, or you hope it's a temporary setback, what can you expect the stock to do, the earnings to do? How long do you think an investor should expect the situation to right itself in order for it to become a successful investment?
Okay. Well, I think one of the keys here is, you know, one of the great things about our country, our culture, is that we have a pretty deep capacity forgive. And we see this time and again when celebrities or even politicians sometimes run into problems. People are willing to, you know, the comeback story is a big one in America. And so that's a key element here. And people also just forget. People just plain forget after a while. We're all busy and, you know, kind of time goes by and we forget. And so that's the case here, I think, with Chipotle. And so the key is the timing. So what you can do is look back at history and say, okay, these situations have happened before. What do we know in terms of how long this takes to wear off? And if you look at those examples that you cited, Jack in the Box, Yum, McDonald's, it takes about a year, really, for these food companies to fully recover from food scares. And so that's probably what we'll have here with Chipotle, assuming they don't have more disasters. And you also, the other key here to remember is that the market tends to be a predictive mechanism. Not always, but a lot of times it predicts, it prices things in about 6 months in advance. So, you know, you have to keep that in mind too, timing factor.
I think there's also a time variation between the event itself, which is reflected in the stock price immediately. Things are marked to market based on the known facts, and the
right.
actual event kind of filtering through the marketplace or the economy. I'm thinking about oil here as an example. So oil stocks get absolutely murdered, and you know, people get very, very worried about what's going to happen because the price of the oil is low. But then everybody's going, well, where are the benefits to the economy of low oil prices? Well, that takes a lot longer to work through the economy. So you've got this dislocation between what's happening right now and the fear that's created by these big events. And yet the
right.
benefits in the case of oil take a lot longer to work out. So, you know, it's not an exact analogy here, but it seems kind of close.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the problems with contrarian investing, and it's a problem that I have personally, is that it's very easy to be too early.
Yeah.
And I'm often too early in names. I tend to just kind of move right in. And it does take a long time for things to play out. I mean, we saw that with the financial crisis. The early warnings were there when the Bear Stearns hedge funds blew up and then some other problems. But that whole thing, it plays out in slow motion. Things
yeah.
play out slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a key. That's exactly right. That's a key part of this.
So you look for strong brand equity. I think we've stated that with the Toyota Suzuki example. What other factor do we look at when we're looking at a particular company? I mean, I guess you're going to want to take a close look at management and see if, you know, how talented they are or passionate.
Yeah, exactly. Management is always key. And one of the things that I always look for in companies, whether it's Amazon or Google or even Netflix, really all names that I've liked early on, is when you have a founder who's running the company, that's a really good situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's proven out by academic studies. You know, it's really interesting to watch the CEO of Facebook, who really just gone through so many changes and how that company's grown, and yet he's still there. And that tells you something about the founder mentality. People are not necessarily in it for the money. They're in it because they love to win. They love to change things. They get excited about developing new products and ideas. And that's the kind of passion you want to see
yeah.
at the top when a problem like Chipotle's comes along. And that's what we have here. We have the founder in there as the manager, and that's, I think, a real key to this situation or any investing situation.
Now, we're not recommending any of these stocks to my listeners at all. We're just talking about them as kind of textbook examples. Chipotle happens to be one that's going through some tough times now, and remember to do your own research. But at least we can learn from investors like Michael, who are concentrating on this area and have experience in them. You know, we were talking about the right management. I mean, one thing that Warren Buffett looks for, he says, you know, everybody who runs the companies that he buys, they have plenty of money. They're not in it just for the money. They're okay. They could all, you know, stop doing what they're doing and be just fine. Buffett also likes to talk about companies that have a moat around them or some kind of a protection built in some way to fight off competition.
Right.
Because competition is fierce. And one of those companies right now, again, just using it as an example, and also the fact that Warren Buffett does own a big stake in this, is American Express. So American Express has had some missteps lately, and yet it has an iconic brand. What do you know about that?
Yeah, that's right. You know, Buffett loves the protective moat, and he loves the brand power. And brand power is so amazing for a company. He's a big owner of Coca-Cola, too, and
mm-hmm.
that's the classic example in my mind of brand power. I mean, basically, what is Coke? Here's a company that basically sells sugar water.
Yeah.
Now, how simple is that, right? And honestly, is their product really that much better than
yeah.
the competitors? I don't really know, but maybe in some cases. But what they're really good at is marketing. You look at all of the classic ads that are case studies in marketing, and a lot of them come from Coke. And that brand power is so key because it gives you. The way one marketing professor explained it to me was it gives you a shortcut into the brain of the consumer.
Yeah.
You know, people are trained, people over time through evolution learned to, you know, go to things you trust and know as a form of protection, as a form of getting safety in life and the world. That's what brands are, really. That's what brands are.
Well, you've got this thing that becomes known in your mind versus kind of the rest of the world, which is kind of unknown. And so it's just a lot easier to go with the known and trust that brand, especially if there's no indication that they've ever misused your trust.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that leads to the moat, and the moat is good because it fends off competitors, it gives you pricing power. Pricing power is another key thing that Buffett always looks for.
Yeah.
And when you have a strong brand, you can charge more. And that's what American Express has done all of these years. Now, recently, that's changed for them. So they have a bit of a problem that they have to deal with. But, you know, they cultivated that brand as an exclusive brand, one you can trust, their customer service is good. And, you know, people like that. People will pay up for that. And, in fact, American Express gets more out of each transaction, mm-hmm. and they charge a lot for many of their cards, not all of them.
They've come under a lot of pressure, though, because some big retailers have dropped them. A lot of their credit card competitors are offering, like, money back and lots of other rewards that American Express doesn't necessarily offer.
Right.
So it's a formidable brand, and it's got, you know, all of these, this 100 years of its iconic brand building, yet, you know, it's a new world for them. So how does one approach a company like American Express? Do you say, well, you know, they're going to get eaten up by the competition, or do you kind of say, well, you know, they fixed themselves in the past, let me see if I can invest at a good price here?
You know, that's exactly the situation with Amex now.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's going to be interesting to watch, because in a way, what they're doing is they're becoming more like the competition. You mentioned that, mm-hmm. you know, they lost their exclusive partnership with Costco, JetBlue, to competitors. And so you have all these other credit card companies who are saying, hey, you know, we'll give you a better deal. Why are you working with Amex?
Yeah.
And so people are listening to that. And Amex, as a response, is rolling out OpBlue. They're doing more cashback, more rewards. They're becoming a lot like their competitors. So the question will be, does this dilute the brand? And it'll be interesting to watch. My guess is probably not. I think they will manage that from a marketing perspective and be able to beat competitors on their own turf and yet keep its niche of exclusivity. And they also, you know, they also have a lot of data on customers. And that's going to be so key as we buy more and more online, is knowing about customers to be able to push deals to them. This is so key. We see this with Amazon and other companies. And they haven't really worked that angle yet, but I think they will. I think big data is the buzz phrase, but I think that'll be a big part of what they do going forward as well.
My guess is Michael Brush. He publishes the stock newsletter Brush Up on Stocks, which can be found at brushuponstocks.com, and he writes for the website MarketWatch. Yeah, so Michael, you mentioned the fact that American Express has this opportunity in big data. It's an interesting point, because many or most of their competitors don't actually have or own the client data. They're kind of intermediaries, if you think of MasterCard or Visa. But American Express has their own database. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's really complicated how credit cards work. It seems simple, but it's not. But basically, Amex has its own payment system end-to-end right throughout the whole transaction, whereas you can think of it this way. Credit cards, they glom onto a system, then they see a piece of it. They see a piece of it, but not the whole mm-hmm. transaction, you know, train from end to end. Amex has that, and that gives them more information on customers, and they will be able to exploit that to develop relationships, not only with customers, but also with merchants. And particularly, you know, they have a lot of room to grow in kind of the small and medium merchant area. If you think of, you know, where you can't use your Amex card, it's often, you know, kind of really small companies, medium-sized merchants.
And, yeah.
So that'll be a plus, right?
Well, the bottom line is that any way that American Express can bring value to the merchants that is over and above what a MasterCard or a Visa can do, and whether it's by providing that merchant with, you know, better data or better pricing or whatever it may be, I guess the bottom line is, and again, we're not making any predictions here, but in the case of a lot of these companies, and I'm thinking about McDonald's right now, they were basically suffering from the competition of a lot of new fast food places that sprung up, Chipotle being one of them, and Panera Bread and so many others. And they kind of lost their way. They had too many products. They had developed kind of a tin ear to the marketplace to a certain degree. But, you know, they let go the people that were managing that. They brought in good people. They have a lot of money to attract the best people. And eventually, not all the time, but there's a good chance that companies of this size with these kinds of resources can turn the ship around. Any final words?
That's right. And, you know, McDonald's is a good example. They were really despised and they got the message and they've tweaked their product line and done pretty well.
To find out more about Michael, go to his stock newsletter, brushuponstocks.com. Michael Brush has been my guest talking about all things stocks today. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Okay, thanks for having me.